content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. We'll begin today with a film review. Bob Dylan's Carnival Act, and this was written by James Parker. Everything, as Charles Peguet said, begins in mysticism and ends in politics. Except if you're Bob Dylan. If you're Bob Dylan, you start political and go mystical. You start as an apprentice hobo scuffling out songs of change. You become, under protest, the ordained and prophetic mouthpiece for a sense of mass disturbance otherwise known as the 60s. And then, after some violent gestures and severances, you withdraw. You dematerialize, you drop it all, and you drift into the recesses of the self, where you remain until they give you a Nobel Prize. James Mangold's a complete unknown, like all the best movies about rock stars, Sid and Nancy, Bohemian Rhapsody, Control, is a fairy tale. It takes liberties. Dylanologists will scream. It dramatizes, mysticizes, elides, elasticizes, and tosses twinking magic showbiz confetti over the period between Dylan's absolutely unheralded arrival in New York in 1961 and his honking, abrasive, Ain't Gonna Work on Maggie's Farm No More headlining appearance 4 years later at the Newport Folk Festival, where his new electric sound drove the old folkies berserk, and the crowd, at least in the movie, bayed for his blood. Timothy Chalamet plays Dylan, and he does it very well, with a kind of amnesiac intensity. He mooches, twitches, mumbles, makes things up, as if the young Robert Zimmerman, in the ferocity of his effort to shed his history and become Bob Dylan, has temporarily cauterized his own personality. Ed Norton, his high forehead glowing with benevolence, plays Pete Seeger, the folk activist father figure whom Dylan will betray. Scoot McNairy, in an amazing wordless performance, plays Woody Guthrie, immobilized by Huntington's disease at the Greystone Park Psychiatric Hospital in New Jersey. Dylan makes a pilgrimage to the Greystone with his guitar and fumbles through a beautiful, uncanny bedside version of Song to Woody. Hey, hey, Woody Guthrie, I wrote you a song about a funny old world that's coming along. Seems sick and it's hungry, it's tired and it's torn. It looks like it's a-dying and it's hardly been born. How did he do that? How did this nobody from nowhere at the age of 20 continue to sound simultaneously like the creaky religious past and the howling incoming future? It wasn't his musicianship. As a guitarist, he was stumpy and street level, and his god-awful harmonica playing now sounds like a kind of a comic punctuation, the harmonica less a musical instrument than a place to put his face after delivering an especially jagged line. But this young old voice, with its swoops and smears and its relentless edge, was a vehicle for cutting through. The world would have to wait for John Lydon of the Sex Pistols to hear another voice so crystallized with frozen wrath. And when his words or his visions reached the pitch of nightmare, I saw a room full of men with their hammers a-bleeding. He sounded not scared, but aroused, as if by imminent and gleeful vindication. The musician Robin Hitchcock, listening to Dylan while pent up in an English boarding school, felt the full revelation. As he describes it in his recent memoir, 1967, Dylan seemed, quote, to have assessed or created a world outside of morality, faith, rules, or superstition. He'd found the sad, doomed kingdom, where things simply are, for no apparent reason or purpose, and whose denizens haplessly wait their fate, end quote. One of the young Dylan's foundational fibs as he skulked and sputtered around Greenwich Village was that he had learned his songcraft while traveling with a carnival. This is important because I've begun to suspect that a major division in American life, perhaps the major division, is the one between carnies and non-carnies. That is, between those who understand instinctively, animalistically sometimes, that life is theater, that people will believe what they want to, and that all the most essential things happen in the imagination, and everyone else. Carnies don't have much respect for reality, because they know they can bend it and knock it around. Non-carnies are condemned to the facts, to what Stanley Elkin called the plodding sequiturs. Was young Bob a carny? He wanted to be, and compared with the courageous and sweetly high-minded Seeger, he certainly was. His identity was a performance. His writing was sleight of hand. He wowed and bamboozled his own audience. And when, in A Complete Unknown, he tries out the carnival story on Joan Baez, played by Monica Barbaro, embroidering it freshly with the addition of a cowboy guitar player called Wigglefoot, she looks at him and says, thrillingly deadpan, "You are so completely full of shit," which is exactly what you say to a carny. And it was all very theatrical, very over the top, the way they lauded him and garlanded him and made him the voice of a generation. Don't all those contemporary cover versions of his songs, with the exception of Hendrix's Smoking All Along the Watchtower, now sound like misunderstandings or mistranslations? The earnestness and humorlessness of the folkies was unbelievable. He had come to save us all. The line would be unbroken from Woody Guthrie to Bob Dylan. The torch had been passed. Except that, if you were Bob Dylan, there was no torch, and there was no one to pass it to, anyway. So he had to be perverse and disruptive, and ungrateful and electrified, and make a noise that would horrify poor old Seeger. Punk rock, avant l'alert. The Complete Unknown makes an especial villain out of Alan Lomax, which is interesting. The venerable activist archivist becomes, in the movie, a thuggish folk enforcer, cursing Dylan for his impurity and tussling with his manager, Albert Grossman, during the set at Newport. It's in the Newport scenes with the crowd roaring in distress that the movie really does some fancy shuffling of events. History records that Lomax did actually brawl with Grossman, but no one at Newport shouted Judas at Bob Dylan. That wouldn't happen until the following year, when he played the Free Trade Hall in Manchester, England. And Ian Bell, in his Once Upon a Time, The Lives of Bob Dylan, makes the point that most of the festival goers at Newport, a hip audience after all, would have known what to expect from Dylan that day. Maggie's Farm, supposedly the main cause of all the Newport trouble, is neither a secret nor a surprise to anyone with the slightest interest in Dylan by the time the festival begins. Dylan's keyboardist Al Cooper has said that 85-90% of the crowd was enjoying the Dylan performance. But so what? A Complete Unknown is a movie, and a movie, or a movie like this, which in one sense is a parable of artistic ruthlessness, needs a climax. And Bob Dylan, more than most rock stars, is a myth. In all senses of the word, he made himself up, he disappeared himself, and in doing so he became a lens. Rays of otherworldly insight poured through him, and he trained them upon us like somebody frying ants with a magnifying glass. He had shimmering visions and torture chambers in his mind. He could make God and Abraham talk with each other, like two other hustlers on a street corner. He let everybody down, ditched everybody, and then taught them how to be exhilarated by that abandonment. Something in me wants to talk about the hard rain that is falling right now, and to wonder who will step up and sing about it. Who will be our minstrel of the end times, our guiding, undeceivable voice, and so on. But to ask that kind of question, to think in those terms, is to lapse into the great mistake, isn't it? And here endeth the lesson of Bob Dylan. Next, Decivilization May Already Be Underway by Adrienne LaFrance. The line between a normal functioning society and catastrophic decivilization can be crossed with a single act of mayhem. This is why, for those who have studied violence closely, the brazen murder of a CEO in Midtown Manhattan, and more important, the brazenness of the cheering reaction to his execution, amounts to a blinking and blaring warning signal for a society that is already too inured to bloodshed and the conditions that exacerbate it. Journalists and other observers have worked to uncover the motivation of the accused killer. This is a worthy exercise when trying to understand a single shocking event. But when attempting to understand how brutality spreads across society, studying individual ideologies only gets you so far. As violence worsens, it tends to draw in and threaten people of all ideologies. So if in the early stages of a violent upswing, law enforcement can see clearly that the greater threat comes from right-wing extremists, which has been the case in the U.S. in recent years, as the prevalence of violence snowballs, the politics of those who resort to it get messier. That's in part because periods of heightened violence tend to coincide with social and political reordering generally. Moments when a party or group identities are in flux, as they are in America right now. As I've written, eruptions of violence are not necessarily associated with a clear or consistent ideology and often borrow from several, a phenomenon that law enforcement calls salad bar extremism. We already understand many of the conditions that make a society vulnerable to violence, and we know that those conditions are present today just as they were in the Gilded Age. Highly visible wealth disparity, declining trust in democratic institutions, a heightened sense of victimhood, intense partisan estrangement based on identity, rapid demographic change, flourishing conspiracy theories, violent and dehumanizing rhetoric against the other, a sharply divided electorate, and a belief among those who flirt with violence that they can get away with it. These conditions run counter to spurts of civilizing, in which people's worldviews generally become more neutral, more empirical, and less fearful or emotional. One way to understand which direction a society is going, toward or away from chaos, is to study its emotional undercurrents and its attitude toward violence broadly. Medieval Europe, for example, was famously brutish, as the German sociologist Norbert Elias wrote in his 1939 book, The Civilizing Process. Impulse control was practically non-existent, and violence was everywhere. But as communities began to reward individuals for proper etiquette, adherence to which was required for entry into the most desirable strata of society, new incentives for self-restraint created substantially more peaceful conditions. The push toward cooperative nonviolence happens organically, whereby people's more animalistic human activities, as Elias put it, took a back seat to the premium they placed on their communal social life. This change in priorities required and perpetuated steady self-control among individuals across society. It is simple enough. Plans and actions, the emotional and rational impulses of individual people, constantly interweave in a friendly or hostile way, Elias wrote. This basic tissue resulting from many single plans and actions of men can give rise to changes in patterns that no individual person has planned or created. And it is this order of interweaving human impulses and strivings, this social order, which determines the course of historical change. Often when people choose violence, it is because they believe that is the only path, a last resort in a time of desperation, and they believe they'll get away with it. Over the centuries, humanity has become more civilized, largely drifting away from violent conflict resolution. And to be clear, I mean, quote, civilized, in the spirit of Elias's definition. The process by which the use of violence shifted to the state and de-civilization to suggest a condition in which it shifts back to individuals. Today, most Americans enjoy extraordinarily peaceful conditions in their daily life. But obviously, violence has never ended, entirely receded, and progress has been uneven. Elias's interest in violence stemmed from his experience fleeing Nazi Germany. And it's a fantasy to believe that an advanced democracy like ours is somehow protected by its very nature against extremism. Democracy can be self-perpetuating, but it is also extremely fragile. Complex societies, and in particular backsliding democratic nations, are often among the most violent in the world. As the writer Rachel Kleinfeld noted in her book, A Savage Order, Mexico saw more violent deaths from 2007 to 2014 than the combined civilian death toll in Iraq and Afghanistan over that same period. Recent bloodshed is not new to America, not even close. Yet this is still a distinctly precarious time, along with layers upon layers of social conditions that make us especially prone to political violence. The Machiavellianism of contemporary politics has stoked both the nihilism of those who believe that violence is the only answer and the whitewashing of recent violent history. This is how society reaches the point at which people publicly celebrate the death of a stranger murdered in the street. And it is how the January 6th insurrectionists who ransacked the U.S. Capitol came to be defended by lawmakers as political prisoners. It matters when people downplay and justify violence, whatever form that downplaying and justifying takes, whether by revising history to say something that was violent wasn't so bad, or by justifying a murder because of the moral failures of the victim's profession. When growing tolerance for bloodshed metastasizes into total indifference for, and even a clamoring in support of, the death of one's political enemies, civil society is badly troubled indeed. My colleague Graham Wood, who has spent much of his career studying the people and societies that resort to violence, has made the case for a greater degree of sanguinity about political violence in America, given how much worse off many other countries are. In Latin America, Wood wrote earlier this year, the violence reaches levels where even a successful assassination is barely news. The thing is, you can't fully understand the extent to which a society has become inured to violence by counting individual attacks or grotesque social media posts. You have to assess the whole culture and its direction over time. A society's propensity for violence may be ticking up and up and up, even as life continues to feel normal to most people. A drumbeat of attacks by different groups or individuals with different motivations may register as different kinds of problems. But take the broad view and you'll find the point at the same diagnosis. Our social bonds are disintegrating. Another word for this unraveling is de-civilization. The further a society goes down this path, the fewer behavioral options people identify as possible reactions to grievances. When every disagreement becomes zero-sum, and no one is willing to compromise, violence becomes more attractive to people. And when violence becomes widespread, the state may escalate its own use of violence, including egregious attacks on civil liberties. The barrier that separates a functioning society from all-out chaos is always more fragile than we'd like to admit. It can take very little for peace to dissolve, for a mob to swarm, for a man to kill his brother. In a society that is consecrated to freedom, as ours is, the power of the people is not only a first principle, but a promise to one another, and most of all, a safeguard against the centralized power and violence of the state wielded against the people. In the weeks after a sharply divided election, ahead of the return to power of a president who has repeatedly promised to unleash a wave of state violence and targeted retribution against his enemies, Americans have a choice to make about the kind of society we are building together. After all, civilization is, at its core, a question of how people choose to bond with one another and what behaviors we deem permissible among ourselves. You cannot fix a violent society simply by eliminating the factors that made it deteriorate. In other societies that have fallen apart, violence acts as a catalyst, exacerbating all of the conditions that led to it in the first place. The process of decivilization may begin with profound distrust in institutions and government leaders, but that distrust gets far worse in a society where people brutalize one another. There is no shortcut back to a robust democracy. But one way to protect against the worst is to force change only through processes that do not lead to bloodshed, and to unequivocally reject anyone, whether that person is sitting in the White House or standing in the street, who would choose to justify violence against the people. And this article, again, was written by Adrian LaFrance, who is the executive editor of The Atlantic magazine. Next, we have a Dear James question, in which James Parker tackles readers' questions. Today's question is about, my phone call anxiety is out of control. I fear I'm on the road to serious isolation. Dear James, I avoid making and receiving phone calls. I mostly don't answer. I feel trapped when on the phone because it's difficult to extricate myself, and I feel burdened by the calls I must or should make, whether to friends, doctors, or relatives. To avoid calls, I rely on texting way too much. I worry I'm on the road to isolation or hermetism. What should I do about this phone phobia? Dear reader, do you remember the days before texting, when everybody would just sit on the public transport blaring away on their phone, quite blandly disinhibited, and you had no choice but to listen? To attend to these monologues and mouthings and maimed half-colloquialies? What a depressing moment in human affairs. Everybody seemed to be telling a story about how clever, brave, sexy they were, or forensically maligning someone else, or both. So texting has at least restored us something of the rigid, impersonal silence that is supposed to obtain when people ride a train together. But of course, it has its problems, too. I like your list of burdensome calls, friends, doctors, relatives. Very suggestive. For what it's worth, I was a great phone avoider growing up. The hunted animal response to the incoming call and the sweating dread of the call you have to make. I relate. And I'm trying to remember how I got over it. I think I probably figured out, eventually, that the cellular damage of unmade and unanswered calls, the spoiled adrenaline in your veins, the shame residue, is worse than the awkwardness of just picking up the frigging phone and getting it done. So be good to yourself and break the cycle. Low-stakes calls first. You will get better at it, I promise. Cocking an ear, James. And another dear James. My boyfriend is about to move in with his ex. I'm a 73-year-old woman who has been dating a man of the same age. We get along famously except for one problem. His previous girlfriend still lives in his home, which he left to allow her to continue living there. For more than a year, he has been staying at a friend's second home, but now it's time for him to go back to his own house. This means he'll soon be living with his ex, as he refuses to change the situation. Why? Her financial situation is not good, and he feels guilty. He doesn't seem to understand why I would have a problem with any of this, as he professes to be in love with me. But I don't think I can continue this relationship as long as he is living with his old girlfriend. Am I being unreasonable? Dear reader, well, people come to all sorts of bonkers arrangements to get through this life together, don't they? Two in the basement, one in the attic. 3 days in this apartment, four in that. I'll take the couch, you take the bed, she'll move to Sweden, and the dog can sleep where he likes. But for the bonkers arrangement to work, all parties need to subscribe to move or less to more or less the same version of reality, which is not the case here. You and your boyfriend, and I'm painting a nice, possibly completely erroneous picture of him in my mind, a hater of change, a pleaser of people, a postponer of decisions, slothful, benevolent, a man after my own heart, really, have reached the old Frostian fork, the place where the two roads diverge. Why can't we all just get along, he wants to know. You, me, my ex-girlfriend, the mailman who stops in for tea. What's so complicated about that? But to you, it's madness. His ex-girlfriend, living with him in his house, sharing a home with him, a domestic space that still has bits of their old relationship lying around in it like used car parts. My advice, kick him around a bit, metaphorically speaking. He may have developed thick, woolly layers of insulation around his brain to protect him from the painfulness and difficulty of life. You must penetrate them better, batter or needle your way through them. Help him understand how silly he is being. He'll get it eventually, or he won't. And if he doesn't, you'll know what to do. Dancing from one difficulty to another, James. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-9138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.